This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 95, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Jonathan Quinn, co-founder and CEO for 14 years of one of London's oldest and best fintechs by far, World First, who since their inception in a basement in Stockwell in 2004 have transferred £65 billion and do over 1 million transfers a year with 600 staff in 7 offices worldwide. And for those of you whose perception is based on PR handouts or the general fintech scene, advertising and fawning tech press coverage, you may not know that a quick scan of price comparison sites shows that World First offer far better value than TransferWise on anything other than tiny transfers. I'll leave Jonathan to fill in this amazing growth story as a whole in a while. But the unique angle and the focus for today is how to successfully expand internationally. This is, it seems to me, the essential hurdle that even the best of the more recently formed UK fintechs have yet to cross at any great extent. It's also one where absolutely the old Top Gear mantra of how hard can it be definitely applies. As I'm still reeling from earlier this week, having had to write over 6,000 words, read them out and then edit it, on everything from the tech implications of the Imperium to how Google's AlphaZero works in the New Year's special, let's have a nice short intro today and dive into how fintechs can have sustainable and scalable growth internationally whilst maintaining agility. A challenge which back in the day kept us merchant bankers very busy. Talking of which, one of my old Climeworts bosses, David Clementi, is their chairman. Since leaving Climeworts about 20 years ago, inter alia, he got knighted, was the deputy governor of the Bank of England, was chairman of the Prudential, and is currently the chairman of the BBC. Not a bad CV at all, eh? And it might give you some idea about how kosher World First are. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Mike.
So we were talking about the need to start with something, I was about to say, more interesting than fintech or FS. But actually, in your case, in your last 14 years, that's probably more interesting than almost anything else we can talk about. And as we're recording this mid-January and the festive season is still upon us, you were saying that you managed to take a break.
Yes, I did. So while, as you say, I find fintech very interesting, to make sure it stays interesting, I occasionally need to think about something else. So I escaped to the Isle of Mull for those moments of sanity, a completely different world from London, and no mobile phone coverage, and try and get outside and escape from people and any thoughts of fintech.
Ah, excellent. And for those people internationally whose knowledge of islands of Great Britain isn't ideal, whereabouts is the Isle of Mull?
The Isle of Mull is on the west coast of Scotland, about 45 minutes from the mainland by ferry.
And how far north is it from the English border to the top of Scotland? I don't actually know myself.
Good question. It's roughly halfway up the left-hand side of Scotland.
Right. So is that almost nearer Iceland than London? Or?
No, it's still quite close to the mainland and benefits a bit from the Gulf Stream, so it really presumes it's going to be terribly cold, but it's actually not too bad.
I've never been up to those kind of parts of the world. My mother did, and it rained all the time, but maybe that was the Isle of Skye. But it's a very different climate up there, isn't it?
It is, although around kind of May, June time, it's as sunny as London by sunshine hours. So if you go at the right time, it can be very beautiful.
Yes, I didn't mention in the introduction that you have also have a part-time job, which somehow you managed to fit in as part of the Isle of Mull Tourist Authority.
Yes, exactly.
Promoting it to people worldwide, and actually that's your real agenda today, yes. Is to spread knowledge of the Isle of Mull. So you fly, presumably, to, I don't know what, Glasgow?
Yeah.
Get a bus, get a boat or something?
2-hour hire car journey to Oban and 45-minute ferry.
Excellent. Well, that's really getting far away. We ourselves got far away in a different direction, probably almost roughly opposite direction, in that we ended up in Amman, where the weather was slightly different. It didn't rain, and in Muscat, it probably rains about 2 days a year or something like that. And there was lots and lots of sand. And if anyone ever goes to Amman, you really have to get to the desert and the proper desert. Anyway, moving on from our school holidays and going on to your other day job when you're not promoting the Isle of Mull, you had, from a brief look at LinkedIn, what I like to call proper jobs back in the old days. As I did, you worked for companies like a good boy, like you're supposed to, like your parents wanted you to. And then one morning or one night you woke up and thought, I'm going to do something different. And not only that, you thought it in days when it was very crazy to go indie. I mean, these days, if you set up a fintech and you're in London, most of your mates will know what it means and what you're doing, and there's a whole marketplace that you're joining. But in your days, it wasn't. So how does the story go from leaving school or whatever, wherever you want to start it, or from being dropped on your head at an early age?
Well, I think I was always interested in business, and I was partly inspired by a couple of sort of Glasgow self-made businessmen of whom I worked for. And so I always wanted to run my own business. But I did, as you say, went to university, went to work for Citibank and RBS, and, you know, learned quite a lot there. But I had set myself a goal of leaving by the time I was 30, which I just managed. And so in the run-up to that, I was looking at different business ideas and kept coming back to this foreign exchange idea, where we thought there was an opportunity to take the sort of product, service and rates that the big guys got and give it to smaller businesses. So that's how we got started.
Excellent. And one of the things I quite like in these podcasts, as I'm approaching 100, is picking up tiny pieces of the sort of historical jigsaw that is what fintech was and where it was and what was happening. And as always, any simple narrative is a simple narrative. So I tend, in my own mind, to have 2005 as a very big figure, when Zopa started and, quotes, invented, unquotes, peer-to-peer. Although then it took about 7 years for all the other ones to sort of start joining in. So you kind of gloss over the fact that that, in a sense, is a kind of combination of more crazy and more impressive than it sounds, because I remember early 2000s, and not a lot of people did that, other than the notable exception of hedge funds, where people were leaving large banks and saying we could do it ourselves. Apart from working with entrepreneurs, which is a motivation in itself, what were your sort of inspirations, or did you literally think you were going into terra incognita on your own? And certainly for me, Stockwell is terra incognita.
As I say, I always had this goal of building up a business. And it was, as you say, it was quite unusual then. And some people thought I was crazy. I was walking away from, you know, working in banking at that time was fairly well paid and I did a nice life. But I did have this kind of burning ambition and, you know, wanted to give it a go. But, you know, we did sort of de-risk it a bit, because Nick and I founded it. But we had gone to meet people and we knew that if it went sort of pear-shaped, that we could probably retreat back into the banks without too much difficulty. But the other thing we did then, which at the time was not unusual, but which now would be unusual, is that we didn't raise any money to start. We saved up for a couple of years and we knew we had enough to start the business. And we went for the start small, think big, move fast approach. And, you know, paid ourselves virtually nothing, did everything in a shoestring. I built the website myself. We did all our kind of collateral ourselves. And then, you know, as soon as things were working, then we kept investing in it. So as a company, we have never raised money. Everything's been kind of funded by the business and profit.
Ah, brilliant. Which may be one of the reasons that you've been a CEO for 14 years and avoided all the sort of politics that comes with having half a dozen VCs on your board squabbling and wanting you to sort of increase your growth rate by a factor of 10 next year, or you know, you're going to sort of swing and all that kind of thing. And it's interesting actually about those days and going back to the history. I think there is an interesting real book to be written about the history of independent financial services players developing over the last sort of few decades. In that, one of my brand partners for last year, Synchron, did exactly the same. And I forgot when they formed, but I think it was roughly about 2004 or something like that, in New York on Wall Street. And the three founders did exactly the same. And they've now grown to something crazy like 16 countries, 8,000 people worldwide, and equally have never raised a penny of equity or debt. And that's, in a sense, the hard way. But in a different sense, it's much more like being an acorn and growing into an oak tree. You get very strong growth.
Yeah.
Even if, of course, there are plenty of times you wish that someone would chuck a bag of compost on you.
Yeah.
Coming back to fintech, this whole fintech phenomenon, or at least the word fintech, and then suddenly all these companies who are called fintechs. As someone who's been around for 14 years in the FX finance indie market in London, what was your perception of when sort of fintech, with a capital F, suddenly came to be a big thing?
Well, yeah, it was probably the third sort of evolution of what we called ourselves. When we started, we called ourselves a foreign exchange company. And then we started to call ourselves an international payments company, because most of our customers actually thought of what they were doing with us as paying someone internationally as opposed to doing a foreign exchange transaction. And then, as you say, this word fintech came along. And to some extent, it's a sort of moniker of the moment. But at the same time, what we are doing with our customers has changed, in that, you know, on day one, 100% of our transactions were telephone-based. They were kind of offline. And now 90% are online. So technology is the medium by which our customers do transact with us now. So it is a justified tag, but also one which is definitely a buzzword. And I wouldn't be surprised if it evolves further.
So as part of that immensely successful journey, as I mentioned before, you're in 7 offices around the world. And as I mentioned in the preamble, I don't know how many offices ClientWatts are in. Your chairman will know. And maybe that is easier said than done. So you very kindly volunteered today to give us all the secrets of successful international expansion, which, as I say, I think will be really important to London fintechs as a whole and to other fintechs in other countries. As in a sense, if you stay in your own market, that's fine, but it's really not the sort of the whole scale thing. And I assume with scale comes better economies and that kind of stuff. So maybe we just start with what is probably obvious, perhaps in people's minds, but actually always starting with basics is really important, because actually if you don't get the basic right, then a lot of, you know, it's like sort of piling bricks on top of each other when the first one wasn't straight in the first place. Why?
So I think the why question is mainly based on the opportunity to scale. And we had ambitions to build a great company and a big company. And that wasn't because I was a megalomaniac and I were megalomaniacs. It was because we believed in what we were doing and we thought there was an opportunity to take it to a wider market than the UK. The second reason, I think, is that as you become more mature in a market, you know, the UK is a fairly crowded market. There are a lot of providers in this market. And there are other countries around the world where there are far fewer providers. So as we were looking at how do we expand the business, you can expand it by offering more products to the same customers, or you can try and expand into new markets. And we were always quite excited by the international opportunity. And we also thought that we would bring benefits by having a global footprint, because we could provide 24-hour service, we might have netting opportunities, and we might be in situations where we could be providing a service to both the sort of importer and exporter, and we wanted to kind of build that ecosystem out.
So coming back to the core of that, a long time ago, a long time before the likes of Currency Cloud and other people who, as I understand it, do retail to wholesale transformations of FX, i.e., in a sense, they buy the wholesale rate off FX and then take a little margin and sell it on to folks in their foreign exchange markets for slightly better. Or I asked Nick Skoronski at Revolut, and he said he's got a very clever computer program. Right, okay, that's nice and clear. You'd set up in the UK and somehow you'd manage to give folks or companies better foreign exchange rates than if they went to a bank. So how did you do that? What's your basic engine? Is it some clever computer program or is it some sort of hand waving?
I think I have to say it's more straightforward than that. I think we simply by doing a large volume, and you know, last year we did £11 billion or something like that, we get very tight pricing. And we simply take a smaller margin than the banks generally do. And particularly in smaller customers, so either smaller businesses or on individuals. And some of that is because we have a lower cost infrastructure. You know, the banks do carry some infrastructure costs around that. We used to work out that we could still service a client doing £5,000, talk to them on the phone, charge a much smaller margin than the banks and still make money.
Okay, nice and simple and clear. So how many years was it then from 2004 in a basement in Stockwell to taking your troops and sending some of them abroad on an aeroplane?
So my co-founder started Australia in 2009. We started in the US in 2012.
So was this after a sort of difference of opinions between you and your co-founder? You decided that we need to go a bit of distance between us. So let's start with the nearest country. Let's start with the opposite of the world.
I think Nick fancied an adventure. Ah, okay. We were looking at the US.
It's certainly an adventure living in Australia.
And yes, so we just kept going from there. We opened our first office in Australia in 2009, America in 2012, Hong Kong 2014, Singapore 2016, and then the Netherlands, and we've got small offices in Japan and Korea last year.
Okay, so that's an interesting progression, and maybe that leads nicely onto the question of culture in these countries. And so from the kind of order you went in, certainly the first half, if not more, are, as it were, very international banking cultures. I was about to say speak English. I mean, sort of Australian version of English and an American version of English. But presumably, in terms of the product in those markets, it was relatively, how simplified can it be? But it's always harder. It was relatively straightforward to be in, say, Singapore and do pretty much what you do in London, because Singapore is kind of, quotes, Western. I mean, you know what I mean, in that context. So there wasn't much sort of cultural thing. Although I'm sure in each of those countries, you have to do a different thing in terms of sales and marketing to get to the local businesses that you serve.
Yeah. So we've always thought about that in terms of we wanted to keep the kind of core about 70%, and 30% we felt we needed to localise for the local market. And that extended to culture, extended to the product that we were offering. You know, we definitely fine-tune it for individual markets, and sometimes those differences are surprising. For example, in Singapore, we have to hire somebody to drive around in a moped and pick up checks every day, which, you know, just doesn't exist in this market. So there are definitely things you have to do differently. There's some things that you have to present differently. Pricing is different. The speed of payment is different. For example, in the US, that's slower than it is here. So there's definitely an element of needing to adapt. And sometimes those adaptations only become clear once you're in market and you kind of learn the hard way that things are a little bit different.
Yes, of course, culture is the prime determinant when you're doing it. I'm interested in your 70-30. And One of the challenges, of course, is that if you go abroad, many American companies tend to do this, as they're not sort of that international in their sort of culture, in a sense, in some ways. Or it's such a large country that they're less aware of it. We as a small island and having an empire, if I use the fact we're a tiny country and other places are rather different. One end of the spectrum is that you go abroad and you continue doing things the same way you do. The other spectrum is that you go abroad and you turn native and you do things in the way they did. And going back to old Kleinwort's days, I remember one of our colleagues who ran Tokyo at the time had gone completely Japanese. And in those days, oh gosh, this is the 90s, I guess. In those days, being Japanese in financial services, that meant you lost a fortune and it showed you one of the boys and, you know, we're going to lose loads of money as well. And yes, that caused a little bit of tension with London. And the other challenge with people far away is that they can sort of, what's the polite way of putting this, use their initiative. So I was running Risk and the good Lord Hugh Trenchard called once and said, oh, I think I probably should ask for retrospective authorization for something I've just done. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting concept, retrospective authorization. Ah, yes, that's something you shouldn't have done and haven't got any permission for. So along this spectrum, how do you handle these challenges of adapting sufficiently to the culture? Because as you say, it can take a long time to understand the culture. I mean, I can move to any one of those countries and I think on day one I know it and I've probably got a reasonable approximation, but 5, 10, 15 years later, I say, oh, actually, no, this is actually slightly different.
Our model to date has been that we try and take one person who knows the business, who understands our ethics, our systems, our processes, and who wants to go and live in that country, and try and pair them up with someone from that country who hopefully knows the local processes and the ways of doing business and how things work, and may even know who are the relevant partners we should be talking to, or businesses, and how to approach them and how to hire people locally. Because one of the most difficult things that I've found is reading people in other countries. You know, if you meet someone from your own country, you can probably fairly quickly read a fair amount about them and get a sense of how good you think they'd be and what their skills might be. The more you get to different countries, particularly if you're crossing language boundaries, the harder it is to do that. And that's where you definitely need kind of local help to get a sense of who you think is a superstar and who's just good at selling you a story.
Yes. Again, thinking back of the various examples myself, I think where there's been that partnership, it's worked very well. And the challenge with managing that partnership is, in a sense, one of power, if you like, the sort of the native. And I use that in the broadest sense. I mean, natives as in the Dutch or the British, vice versa, or the Scottish, is that if the native has all the knowledge, then he can somehow just actually go off and start doing things, or equally if the expat knows how sort of the home office works. And on the language point, it's even a challenge when people speak good English. So in my days in fund management, I did a lot of work in Japan, and a lot of the clients spoke excellent English, better than me. But it took me some time to realise that they used English words in a different way from I did. So, you know, for a couple of years, I would go over there and I'd say, oh, Jonathan, can you do this? And, you know, and by the time I'm back, and that, yes.
Yes.
I thought, oh, that's good. So I write that down, move on to the next one. Come back 6 months. So did you do it? Yes. And then, you know, eventually work out, no, you didn't do it. But, yeah, you know, that's a kind of tendency not to cause the other side to lose face and tend to use the word yes. And as I've joked about before, Iceland tends to be the opposite. If you ask any question, nay, they love saying nay. No, absolutely impossible. So, you know, even when people speak very good English, they use it in a very, very different way.
Absolutely. And the ideal scenario is you find somebody who's in that market, who understands the local market, how it all works, speaks the local language, knows the local people, but ideally has perhaps spent time in your culture. So they've been to university in the UK,
exactly,
or the US or something, and therefore they can bridge that cultural gap. And they can talk to the local people in the local way you need to talk to the local people, and they can talk to me in the way that they need to talk to me, and then you can really know what's going on, but also make sure you're not upsetting people along the way.
Absolutely. And, you know, a prime example of increasing importance in the world these days is China. As I mentioned on the podcast, I've done, you know, a whole bunch of Chinese stuff one way and another, off-piste and nothing to do with sort of finance. And as I was bemoaning in the New Year special, I don't like this whole sort of focus on race and all this kind of stuff and generalizations and all that kind of thing. But in this particular case, the Chinese can be very inscrutable. And that is not a cliche. That's just the truth. You know, and going back to reading people, it can be damned impossible to read someone you've known for a decade.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, China is our biggest market, which, you know, I don't think many people know. And so it's an extremely important market, and therefore very important that we really understand the people we're dealing with and the people that are working for us. But it's also very interesting because, you know, China has different rules, and in some things they may be stricter and some things they may be less strict than us. And understanding that, we think, is absolutely crucial to doing business in that country. You need somebody on the ground who can tell you what things really mean and what the rules really are, and who you really need to know and who you need to be talking to.
And going back to Scottish Islands, I think, again, just being racist for a moment, I think that actually being Scottish is a great advantage in this. I saw on YouTube, I think, over Christmas, what would happen if you reversed all the emigration that ever happened in the world and immigration and all that kind of stuff. Well, you can't do it since the beginning of time, otherwise it'd be sort of Lucy in Africa or something, but just kind of in the colonial periods or whatever. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the country whose population would increase about sevenfold would be Ireland. The Irish went everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I think the second country after that was Scotland.
Yeah, I can totally believe that.
Scotland would be absolutely packed out if everybody, as it were, came back who left for the last several hundred years, or their descendants.
Yeah, I think they always say that there's as many Scots abroad as there are in Scotland. Now, that may be to do with the rain, as you mentioned, but I hope it's more about that pioneering spirit. And interestingly, Macquarie, who obviously was one of the sort of forefathers of Australia, was from the Isle of Mull.
Oh, there we go. More Isle of Mull.
Exactly.
Tourism. So we've got the opportunities, we've got why go abroad, the big markets out there which may be less competitive than here. One of the motivations, if I can call it evangelical, is that you're doing something for, quote, society as a whole, and the market is liking it, the market is buying more of it. So why not spread that around the world and make the world a better place? And then the prime challenge, again, we had this with the sort of Germans, there's an infinite amount of sort of conversations one can have about this, and it's an ongoing thing forevermore in a way, which is that the cultures are different. And reading into what you're saying there, I do hear a huge amount of respect, which I think is absolutely vital, for the local cultures rather than judging. I saw something about coffee. I was in a coffee shop. I went to see The Last Jedi. Let's not talk about that. I was in a coffee shop in the morning and flicking through a brochure at coffee. It was really sort of coffee place. And there was a huge hoo-ha because, you know, the world coffee tasting being held in Dubai, and they've got a terrible culture out there, and it's outrageous, and how dare they do this and that. Well, maybe, maybe not, but everybody's got a different culture. It's their country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I genuinely find almost every country you go to, I think, is fascinating. And, you know, they just have different ways of doing things. But generally, you know, most of the countries which we're in, I think, are all brilliant countries. I mean, I have huge respect for China. It's one of the factories of the world. It's the world's biggest exporter. It exports over $2 trillion worth of goods a year.
Yes, we're in a similar sort of, although you're sort of somewhat foreign, we're in a similar cultural background here, which is a sort of living on an island, a fascination with the rest of the world, because actually there's quite a lot of it. So one of the points that we were mentioning when we spoke on the phone, I thought was a rather good one, again, plays to my old experience, which is the importance of assessing risk correctly. And a metaphor I used in the past was that by and large, and this tends to be amongst credit people, there can be a defensive view of risk, which is, oh, it has to be avoided. And regulators, oh, avoid risk. Okay, there's a certain amount of that. I mean, I won't try and sort of run and jump across the Thames. That's a good idea. But actually, a much more appropriate framing is a bit like a football match. You're going to let in goals. Things are going to go wrong in life. But actually, what matters in a business context is you score more goals than you let in, simplifying it. So how does your perception of risk come into expansion?
Well, I think anybody that's, you know, an entrepreneur or who's running a business is constantly managing risk. But I think that people often overprice risk. They worry about risk too much, or they're irrational about risk. And funnily enough, the same percentage of 70% is the one that I like, is that people often try and become 100% sure of a business. So I meet somebody who says, I'd love to start up a business, I've got this idea, and they're trying to get to be 100% sure before they start. And you're never going to get there, because there will always be some risk, you know, if you do your SWOT analysis. But if you can get to be about 70% sure, I think you should go for it. We did a big survey last year of businesses asking them why more didn't go international. And if you really boil it down, it was often that it was a kind of hassle. It was something they meant to do, but they were always a bit busy with their current business and they never really got around to it. But when you actually spoke to them about, well, the opportunities of international, because, you know, there's 70 million people roughly in the UK and 7 billion in worldwide, you're only addressing 1% of the world market if you're only in the UK. So there is a vast market out of there. And if you come back to fundamentals, you know, if you go to Asia, generally the growth rates are higher. So fundamentally, there's a good chance of sort of growth, and there's periods of change. So there's the willingness to embrace new businesses and new ideas. So I think that people need to kind of come back to risk. And if you can't get to that 70%, you know, you have to keep kind of analysing, try to get more information. And either you then decide, well, it's not the right thing to do, or you push yourself over 70 and then you have to kind of go for it. And I think you have to carve out and prioritise international development, because it is something that is very easy to slip. You have to have a sort of dedicated person, and the person we have sits outside the other reporting lines. She reports directly to me, so that the internal immune system of the business doesn't close in on that, because it's a hassle and a risk and it's additional work. And you need to have somebody that can focus on that. And I think that maybe brings me then on to how do you choose where to go, because the world is a big place. And the approach, again, that we've taken has been one of two things. One is to take a very rational approach. So looking at where is there a lot of exporting or importing, and where do the bank rates look high, therefore there's an opportunity for us. But I think that if you do that, you risk missing opportunities. I think you also have to look at your gut feel. You know, where do you just feel there are opportunities? And this is where you need to get out. You need to get on a plane and you need to go and visit these countries and talk to people. There's a great book, Never Eat Alone. You know, you should always be out, you know, find opportunities, go and talk to people who's doing things in that market. You know, things like DIT or the government can sometimes help with this. Go and work out what are all your market opportunities, go to the countries, work out what looks interesting or exciting or opportunistic, and then combine that with some rational analysis.
Excellent. That sounds brilliant. I mean, on the risk front, one of the challenges is also that generally people don't assess it very well.
Yeah. And that overpricing of risk we see in other areas as well. We talk to some of our customers and some of them don't go international and they say, well, it's because they're worried about fraud. And then you look at what are the actual fraud rates in international transactions, and then you ask them what their profit margin is, and their profit margin is 10 times the fraud rate. So it's actually just a risk they should accept. You should mitigate it, try to reduce it, but you should accept it as a part of doing business.
Absolutely. So before we go on to World First more directly, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there in all the countries around the world. And my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motive Finance, combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500,000 of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So in terms of wrapping up with World First, we mentioned, I was about to say the word FX, but maybe the two letters FX together a few times. But maybe just in terms of filling us in a bit more specifically, Jonathan, what does World First sell to who? In terms of the thousands of listeners out there, some of them no doubt who aren't using you should be your customers. Who are they? And then maybe tell us a little bit more about where you're going in the broadest sense, not just sort of in terms of another few countries.
Sure. So actually, a lot of people have a misperception of us. We are actually 86% B2B. So the main thing we do is either provide services to importers who are paying suppliers around the world, or our biggest market is providing bank account solutions globally and international payments to exporters. And we're helping them collect money around the world. So those exporters are generally e-commerce merchants. I think we were the first into that market. We now look after about 60,000 e-commerce merchants.
How do they find out about you in general?
So either they may be Googling and they may find us, or partners are a key part of how we acquire customers. So we partner with some big companies or some companies that in relevant sectors who introduce clients to us, or word of mouth is still a very key source of business for us.
And in terms of the future, what are you doing at the moment that's interesting?
So our big focus is around our World Account. It's a product we launched in May last year. And this is a product that can give any business globally a suite of bank accounts around the world that are local accounts. They can then collect money from their customers locally, pay their suppliers locally, move money between those accounts or to their customers almost instantly at a lower cost. And it's the sort of first stage in building a suite of products which we hope will provide all of the tools, products and services that people who are trading internationally need on one platform.
So you're becoming a one-stop shop.
That's the goal.
And as I say, you've done brilliantly. You're too modest to say that. But as you emphasised, as a CEO, as a board of a fintech, using the term broadly, you need to retain the growth mindset.
Absolutely.
The job's never done.
Yep.
You always need
yep.
to get up in the morning. There's always something in your inbox. And there's always something that we could do with more of in life and in business. So what would World First want more of in 2018, in case anybody listening has got it or is it?
Well, I think we are always looking for smart developers, because you know, fintech is technology and technology is the basis of everything we do. I think we're always looking for new opportunities to get our product out to more people. And I think, you know, we're looking for other countries that we may also expand into. And I think we'll be starting to do more of that in the next couple of years.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that tour d'horizon of international expansion. It is a fascinating area. And Rennie, who reached out to me via email, I said to her that, of course, as you can imagine, millions of people email me a day saying, can we be on the show and their company is really wonderful and all that kind of stuff. And actually, it is a very, very rare case that something is wonderful. And I think that you guys have done an absolutely fantastic job. And I wasn't just mentioning David Clementi to fill out the intro. It was because, knowing David, he's extremely solid. You don't become the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England and the Chairman of the BBC without being extremely solid. And the fact that he's been your Chairman for some time really does demonstrate that World First is a really very serious company. You've been going for 14 years, which is far, far, far longer than all the whippersnappers in the more recent wave of fintechs, and in particular in terms of the developers that you mention. A number of them may not have heard of you so much if they're not in the FX area, but I would definitely recommend that they check you out. And you mentioned the importing and exporting. If the world is to keep growing, and let's not mention the Brexit thing and all that kind of stuff, importing and exporting is a great thing, not least of which, not just for the economics, but also for connecting countries and connecting people. And going back to how I finished the New Year special, the Native American phrase, Nitakuya Oyasin, all our relatives, the more that we can join these countries together, the more that we can work together and respect everyone's culture, so much the better, above and beyond simply providing the foreign exchange. So it's been a fascinating conversation, Jonathan. I don't think there's anything you've said, actually, which sort of jarred with me. I think, you know, you've no doubt had plenty of challenging experiences along the way where things didn't work as smoothly as they might. And the good thing about that is that as long as you pick yourself up and the next day go on and don't make the same mistake again, then over time you learn. And you guys have had lots of learning. So I wish you every success in the future, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance with me.